When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. The views and opinions you are about to hear are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else. Now on to the podcast.
Welcome back to the PFC podcast. This is Dennis and today I am with Abrik. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks. Appreciate it.
So we've been on one of our podcasts earlier, but that was kind of a group discussion. Would you mind doing just a real quick introduction?
Sure. My name is Abrik O'Kelly. I spent some time in third group and first group and got out and married a local here in Europe. So I've been in Europe for about 20 years in four or five different countries. And I've kind of set up a nonprofit college to push forward the evidence-based medicine in austere environments.
Nice. I'm proud to say that I'm currently in one of your courses, and it's really great stuff.
Yeah, you're doing the Masters of Austere Critical Care.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So we're looking forward to seeing you get through the program.
Yep, and I am 100% thrilled to see the end of the program. But today we're going to talk about improvised medicine. It's one of those things that. It's one of those skills that's invaluable to know, especially when you're dealing with the austere environment, because things go wrong and we just have limited supplies. And it's, I think, super relevant for the times going forward, especially when everybody's up in arms about LISCO and conflicts in Ukraine and conflicts in Burma and like conflicts everywhere that are large scale. Large amounts of casualties, you're going to run out of stuff. Now what do you do? So I think this is a super relevant topic.
It is, and they are in Eastern Europe at the moment, running out of everything. And yeah. This hopefully will be relevant for them.
Yeah. So kind of without further ado, you have a presentation on improvised medicine. So if you don't mind, let's start that and kick this off.
Roger. There, do you see that?
Yes.
Okay, good. So, yeah, let's talk about improvised medicine. I've broken down improvised medicine skills into the MARCH algorithm. So during each of the MARCH, we'll talk about applicable improvised techniques that can help you out. And then there's a lot in PFC, so we'll talk quite a bit about that. So starting off with massive hemorrhage, we need to talk. I call this the most important improvised skill because if you can figure out an improvised tourniquet, then you can save a lot of lives. I think of like Boston bombing, like how many casualties were there? If you remember, Dennis, there was a picture of a guy in a wheelchair and he had his bones sticking out and there was some other guy holding the leg, trying to keep it from bleeding. Something like the ability to create improvised tourniquets would have really been beneficial in a situation like that.
Oh yeah, 100%. Also the knowledge of stopgaps, like instead of a gorilla grip around the thigh, you know, solid pressure on the femoral artery at the pelvis.
Yeah, pressure points. That definitely, we'll get to that with the junctionals. But so here's a couple pictures of our TTEMS courses in Malta, in Pretty Bay, Malta. So we teach improvised medicine in pretty much everything that we do. And here we have four people showing the improvised tourniquet. And you'll see a QR code where you can scan that, and there'll be a video. And Dennis, I'll be happy to send you the links so you can add this to the notes so you can see how this works. So the trick with improvised tourniquets is width. So if you think about the cap tourniquets we have, they're what, an inch and a half. And they work, right? They're evidence-based, but they're not the best because they're not wide enough. So if you think of in surgery and in a theater, they have something called a bear block. That's like, what is it, 6 inches?
Yeah. Essentially a BP cuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super wide, and it's a better tourniquet than a better tourniquet than the cap. So in the legs, we use 2 cap tourniquets, don't we? Because the extra width is going to make less pain, it's be more effective, and be better for it. So when we improvise, we want wide swath of bandage. So the rule of thumb I use for improvised bandages is it's got to be as wide as the palm of your hand. And anything narrower than that, when you put pressure on that, it just turns into like a rope and you lose cool points. It's just not working. So we cut strips of bandages out of sheets, out of pillowcases, out of shirts, out of trousers. And as long as the strip of cloth is no narrower than my palm, then they can use it. And they want it about 2 meters long. For the tourniquet, the improvised tourniquet, so you're going to find the center point of that bandage, and you're going to drape it over the arm or the leg, and you're going to wrap opposite directions on each of those tails until you have about half a meter left. And then you make a knot, put some windlass in there. So shears will work, stick, anything you can think of, cleaning rod from an M16, and then you keep twisting until the bleeding stops, and you've confirmed with ultrasound that the bleeding has stopped. And that's the trick with the improvised tourniquet is you got to keep it wide, and there has to have a windlass. And there's so much research out there that if you don't have a windlass, you're losing cool points. So you need to do that with the improvised. So if you're running your lanes, what have you seen people use for improvised tourniquets, Dennis?
Not a heck of a lot as far as improvised, just regular tourniquets. Usually they'll try to do like a pressure dressing, right? Like a real good pressure dressing, and they wrap it so tight that it actually becomes a tourniquet anyway, just because the adrenaline is going so high. And that's something to be aware of too. If you're trying to do just a pressure dressing, like you should be able to feel a pulse, right? Usually like ACE wraps, they'll try and do a pressure dressing, and they'll just put so much torque on it that it actually becomes a tourniquet.
With that one, I have, it's called a pinky test. When you do a pressure dressing, you stick your pinky on the opposite side of that dressing. If you can't stick your pinky in underneath that pressure dressing, it's no longer a pressure dressing, it's a tourniquet. So you definitely need to pinky test it.
Right. I would just say with, you know, like the pinky test, that works when the guy has higher blood pressure. You know?
Fair one, yeah.
You know? Yeah. You should be able to see, well, you don't want to see any bleeding, but you definitely, if he's got a pulse somewhere, you should be able to feel a pulse. Like cap refill, I think, should start happening. Checks like that. And that's another thing, you know, improvised tourniquets, like we're already down the line as far as equipment goes. Once this guy starts getting, with any kind of tourniquet, once this guy starts getting some kind of resuscitation, you constantly have to recheck. And I would suspect an improvised device of any kind, you need to check this stuff more frequently.
Yeah. And having the ultrasound there to check for your pressure bandage as well. So get a Doppler ultrasound to make sure that you have fluid flowing around distally. But for improvised tourniquet, yeah, you definitely need your ultrasound out to make sure that it's fully a tourniquet. Yeah. So moving on, under massive hemorrhage, we're going to put binders as well, because at least at Coram, we classify a pelvic bleed as massive hemorrhage. So we need to bind pelvises. And well, my favorite is putting a SAM splint inside an orthopedic tubi gauze strip. And that way you have a couple of tails on each end of your SAM splint. You can use, well, you can use a SAM splint as a normal fracture on an arm fracture, but you have the extra tubi gauze to be able to wrap and do a pelvic binder as well. So back in the 80s and early 90s when I started, this was what we had. An improvised pelvic binder was a bed sheet. And this one, I love this photo. Is that the right place for a pelvic binder, Dennis?
Well, I mean, it looks a little high just from what I can see in the picture. It'd be helpful if I could have some kind of reference. The towel is covering it. But it looks, just from the look of it, it looks like it's above the pubic symphysis. And I can't really see anything on the hips. But just from the quick guess at it, way that, especially the way it kind of drops down in the middle, I would expect it's above the pubic symphysis.
So this is something that we drill heavily into the college is you must be in the right location. Everyone puts them high or has a tendency to put them high, especially when we're improvised. Yep. So we got to have it at the pubic symphysis. The other thing about binders is the best poundage, best pressure is 32 pounds of pressure on a pelvic binder. And the challenge with the bed sheets or any of these improvised is how do you know when you have 32 pounds of pressure to close that open book fracture?
Yeah. And it's, I found it to be very difficult. So we don't have lots of bed sheets, but I have seen using like the, not the HPMK, but like the foil sheets.
Oh yeah, the myelin.
Yeah, the myelin sheets.
Yeah.
You know, it tears super easy, but when you bundle it up, it's actually pretty freaking strong.
Yep.
But the trick is getting that pressure, and guys forget that this thing hurts. Like if somebody actually has a broken pelvis, any binder, that sucker hurts, and they tend to stop when somebody yells out in pain.
You think there's broken edges of pelvis, and as you close that open book fracture, those bone fragments are pushing up against each other. Of course it hurts. Yeah. And this is, you know, ketamine and paracetamol and midazolam combination would definitely be warranted.
But, oh, yeah. I did have a question that kind of, it always comes up. And so, you know, you're on the X, you're on the scene of whatever it is. You suspect somebody has a pelvic fracture because of whatever the mechanism is, car accident, whatever. You have to roll the patient, assuming, let's say, they're on their back or on their front. At some point, you're going to have to roll them, right?
Yep.
I try to explain to the guys, like when you're doing your march assessment, you're going to want to expose the extremities. That's part of it, just so you can see whatever kind of injuries they have. So you can put your tourniquets and junctionals and et cetera, et cetera. And I try to explain to them, like, have a plan to cut the clothing and not just slash at it and, you know, tear up material you have, so that when you have a junctional, if you have a plan to just either cut up or cut down the pant leg, you have a improvised pelvic binder so that you can stabilize it if you have to roll. And it might not be perfect, and you might not even have the perfect pressure on it. Get that sucker tight, tie it, you know, and then roll. What are your feelings on when to roll a person with a fractured pelvis? Because you have to look at the downside.
You have to check the back, and you have to get something fuzzy underneath them as well. We're talking about that thermal challenge on keeping them warm. So no, you have to roll them. So the best you can do to stabilize that pelvis as you roll is and so we've tested the cutting of the trousers up, the strips up the trousers, and then tying that, and we're not getting 32 pounds of pressure, but we are getting stabilization, aren't we? And how we test this is we'll do a pinky test. So we'll try to stick a finger down Sam's sling. Sam's sling is perfect. It's 32 pounds when it clicks, when you close it. So that is evidence-based of what the Sam Medical Company has shown in peer review, that 32 pounds is what you need. So you can try to stick your finger in somebody wearing one of those. You can kind of get in, but so that you have an idea of how much you need. So when you improvise a bed sheet or a jacket or a Mylar blanket, you can try to see if that's strong. And if it isn't, you can try using a windlass. It's like the cut up pants are great. You can do the tie, put a cleaning rod in there, whatever you can, and start doing a windlass to make it 32 pounds of pressure. I would highly suggest that before you roll them, because we're looking at a catastrophic hemorrhage, aren't we? So if you, and we have to roll them because we got to put something soft under them. So, and then check the back and the armpits and everything else. And that is either done in M or C, massive hemorrhage, or well, you can do it in respiratory as well. But by the time, we should say, by the time you get down to C, if you haven't looked at the back, and if they're not laying on something fuzzy, you failed. You're losing cool points. So yeah, I think you're right that if you can do the cut up of the pants, it's helpful, because any other bed sheet you're doing, you have to shove underneath the small of the back, and then you got debris underneath or the sand or something. And so I think the cut up the legs is brilliant if you add a windlass to it.
Yeah. And kind of the pants, I mean, they're already in place, right? It's just a matter of making sure you cut up to the right distance to get it into the right spot as far as the pubic symphysis.
Yep.
You don't have to shimmy something else underneath it, which is going to cause a lot more pain and shift bones and things around. And it's like I said, it's wide, right? It's going to cover the entire pelvis. And that's one thing that when guys, you're packing the SAM junctional, or, you know, any of these like tactical pelvic binders, they're always narrow. And guys forget, like, the narrower this thing is, the more accurate you have to be, and the more likely it's going to shift. And just that little shift is going to put it completely out of place.
Absolutely. So the trousers they're wearing are going to be a good option. But the one trick that we've seen, though, the strips you cut of the pants to make the tie have to be on the outside. What we found is if you cut on top of the leg, suddenly you don't have enough space to do a windlass or to do a tie. So they have to be cut up the side. And then you cut up to the willy line, the pubic symphysis. Yep. So I don't look at the greater trochanters anymore. Who's going to have time to look at that, get an ultrasound, try to find? No. So just the pubic symphysis. So that's where we aim for. And then put your windlass device on top of that to make it hopefully as close to 32 pounds as you can.
Yeah. And don't forget, tie the feet so that the feet don't move. And at the minimum, tie the feet and ankles together so they can't move. And then ideally, something around the knees. That's something I don't say everybody forgets, but the vast majority, if they forget something, it's going to be tying the feet. And you still got to roll the guy on, at least onto the litter, right? And, you know, even if you pick him up, you're going to be moving those bones around, which is going to cause more shear.
I like when I teach this for our students in Malta is to, I did it in the Insakan course in Pfullendorf as well. So you put the binder on, and then I grab the foot and I say, all right, put your hand on their hip right above the binder, right? And I'll wonk their foot back and forth, and they'll feel how much the hip moves when you just move the foot a little bit. And that it's a take-home message. It is not a complete binder until you bind the feet, and then you have some sort of fuzzy in between the legs, and then the knees is grand as well if you can, but at least the feet. And I fail students if they are not, if they do a binder and then they move on to A or R and they haven't bound the feet. I'm like, your patient died. You know, what happened? And we gotta realize that you're gonna continue to bleed as long as your feet are wonking around a bit. So yeah, bind the pelvis, bind the feet. Yeah. Good. There are other improvised binders out there. The yoke on the left with the SAM splint and a belt. And look how high that is. It's nowhere near the base of the pubic symphysis. So, and you're just not going to get that 32 pounds. You know, it's better than nothing, but you're not going to get 32 pounds. So the one on the right, I nicked this off the SAM medical site. So as just an indication on where that buckle should be, or when you improvise, where your knot in your windlass should be. And it's right at the pubic symphysis. When I was teaching the MOD, the UK guys in the battles course, they had a saying called buckle to bollocks. So that buckle of that SAM splint should be right at the pubic symphysis. And that's the only, that is the location it has to be. Otherwise it's not working. And I'm glad you mentioned bind the feet, because you lose cool points if you don't have that.
Yeah. And would you mind just going back quick? Yeah. But you notice it's not just a wrap around the ankles. You know, they're involving the feet within it so that the feet can't rotate in and out. So you got to incorporate the feet within that. Whether that be duct tape or anything.
Yeah. So, tape around the
toes there.
Big toe, if you have to, that works. And they need to put something fluffy between the feet or between the legs there. And I'm going to completely ignore the fact that this picture has a spine board in it. we don't acknowledge those at all. But you're right. Bind the feet, which includes the toes. So improvised junctional tourniquets. So everyone loves the Nalgene on the left. And I agree, it works really well. And the center one is a stone with some cat tourniquets. And on the right is a SAM splint with a BP cuff. So we can talk about some of the options here. The Nalgene, I totally agree that the Nalgene or something like that works really well. The stone, when I was teaching with Dr. Hagman at DMI, for some reason, Marines always just went out and grabbed a stone. And I don't know how many times I've seen them do that. And some of them, like, 30 kilo stone, just a gigantic thing. And we just got to tighten the shock group and say, no. And the thing with the stone, as soon as you move, what's going to happen to that rock?
Yeah, it rolls.
It rolls. So, you're losing cool points on that. And let's the one on the right, the SAM splint with the BP cuff. The thing with any pneumatic device in an austere environment, it's just going to lose air. So, in my experience, I'm saying that the Nalgene bottle or something like that is going to be a better option. What have you seen as far as?
I mean, I've seen the Nalgene bottle. I haven't seen the stone. So maybe we got different kinds of Marines in our courses. I've seen the pneumatic, like the SAM junctional. It works. It works pretty well. I think just like the stone, whatever improvised thing you have, guys want to have like this, quarter size or 50 cent piece size, pressure point on that vessel, and they don't realize like you still have to move this person. Like we're an M, we have to move on, and that's going to involve movement of the patient, and so inevitably you're going to have some kind of role. Where I see people go wrong is they don't practice these things. They don't practice the device itself, improvised or not, and they don't secure it And that securing could be with a pelvic binder. That could, I've seen it done with ACE wrap or any kind of elastic wrap. It could be with anything, but it's got to make, and you have to practice making that bomb proof. And it's in that practice that you find what works and what doesn't.
Yep. And if you look at the left picture with the Nalgene bottle, the Nalgene bottle is kind of going along the same direction as your artery, which is a no-go. You have to have very much a perpendicular to the artery you're trying to stop, and that way the entirety of the device of your Nalgene bottle is putting pressure somewhere and where it's supposed to be. That's a challenge, isn't it? You put a Nalgene bottle, instead of going up and down like that, it's kind of aiming off to the hip. Now, how do you secure it? Because the two cap tourniquets you put back to back in order to put to pressure on that, it's not going to work because the Nalgene bottle is kind of going off at an angle. And unless you try this, well, in a classroom setting first, and then you try it on the lanes, you're just not going to get the idea of why the Nalgene bottle or whatever rolled up device you have has to be perpendicular to the artery you're trying to stop.
Right. And not to mention like time, right? Like you need to have a really good stopgap because this thing takes time to get in place. It takes time to secure. And this is an injury that takes 10 minutes, 5 minutes to bleed to death. You know? Practice those junctionals, knowing where to place your hands, where to guide other people to place their hands to stop the bleeding with just pressure. And then, in place this device in a timely manner. And only through, like you said, only through practice are you going to know the finer points of what you have to do and how you have to secure it in order to make this thing work. Because we're already, we're improvising. The whole thing is we're improvising. So, all the pre-made stuff is already used. And, now we're starting to scrape the bottom when it comes to supplies.
Yeah. And you're not going to have two cat tourniquets available to make a really good device to hold that Nalgene bottle in there. And then it's going to slip. And so that's kind of a, like every minute, every 2 minutes, somebody needs to be checking that because you're now moved on to R and C, and you're doing all sorts of other stuff, and you forget the fact that it's moved, even though you haven't even moved the casualty at all. It's just kind of slipped. And having ultrasound or Doppler available to check the popliteal artery to make sure it's occluded or do what you can. But you're losing a lot of fluid as you apply this. And then if you want to lose sight of it and over the next 2 or 3 minutes it moves, you're going to be bleeding out again. So it's almost like you have the 18 Bravo on the team just there. Your job is to keep an eye on this and let me know if anything changes.
Right. So here I have another question just about your thoughts on stop gaps in between, like just manual pressure. So TTRIC, warning against, they call it dropping the knee, like where you put your knee in that crease. But then they advocate putting your hands there as well. Like that's a better option. So
in order to get the knee, yeah.
So in order to get enough pressure, you're essentially doing a push-up off this guy's pelvis. I mean, if you actually know where you're pushing, it doesn't really take that much pressure, but in that moment, everything is gross motor movements, right? So they're putting their fist into it and essentially doing a push-up off it, which a bullet or a piece of metal just went through that spot. And not only is it severed an artery, which is why we're doing this, but it's probably messed up the pelvis itself. Now I'm doing a push-up off a broken pelvis,
Yeah. I remember in the 90s, we were taught knee in the groin, and then I think science came out that showed very few people were right in midline and right on the artery, let alone the fact that he has a open book pelvic fracture or through a gunshot wound by a 50 cal and there's just shatters everywhere. And now you're kneeling on it and causing more pain, more bleeding, more. Nope. So I'm not a big fan of the knee because the knee is just not articulate at all. But your hands, yes, your hands, you can kind of get an idea of the place you want to do and then the push up. But you've got to make sure that you're not causing more harm as you do that. So I'm a big fan of, and you can try doing pressure points to slow it down, but I'm just not a big fan of the pressure points. Your focus should be getting that definitive tourniquet or improvised tourniquet or whatever you can to stop the bleeding and not moving around on. I'm sure if you got tons of people and he doesn't have a pelvic fracture, sure, have a go. Get the 18 Charlie, 18 Bravo in there and do what he can because you've already taught him kind of how to do that. But your mission is stopping that bleeding. And scientists have shown again and again and again, you need a tourniquet, and when a windlass tourniquet, you need two of them on the leg. That's what you should be focusing on. And it's even more so if you're a solo practitioner. No, I remember in the 90s, put a knee. Okay, now put a tourniquet on. How the hell am I going to do that? I got a knee on the groin and the tourniquet is down by the, how am I going to, no, you can't. I'm not a huge advocate if it slows you down. Let's move on to airway a bit. So we talked about massive hemorrhage. We'll talk about airway, and everyone loves the surgical airway, don't they? And everyone has their wazoo straw or something. And I just call bollocks on everything unless it passes both physics and science. So here's the rule of thumb we have at the college. Any wazoo device you have to improvise an airway, first, see if you can breathe through it. If you can breathe through it, then you can start thinking about that. But if you can't, so people like a pen, let's see, I think I have this. Yeah, the next slide. So everyone loves, it's a pen, it's great. Well, I've tried breathing through those government pens. They're just, and I'm not, hurt. I'm not, I'm definitely jacked up on adrenaline trying to treat this guy. Yeah, but I'm not hurt and I'm not have difficulty breathing. So you want to put something that sized into a guy and have him breathe out of that. It's just not going to work. So you need to have something you can breathe out of. So the ET tube for surgical airway is obviously best bet. I remember being taught in the 90s that you cut the ET tube. Don't do that. Don't do that. Please don't. Not only do you lose your device to keep it static by inflating the tube, but you also have a sharp device. The other thing I learned way back was the drip chamber. And I still see people teach this because it's so sexy. You cut the drip chamber and it perfectly fits into a BVM, right? So you look cool. And then you shove that other end into the throat and then suddenly people can breathe, but you can't. I've tried breathing through that. This picture here is me trying to carve a wider lumen into that drip chamber to make it work. No. So you need to have a surgical device that is going to work that the person can breathe through. Something like a camelback tube, could you breathe through that?
Yeah, I would think so.
Probably, now, yeah.
Will it fit?
What else? Well, that's the other thing. So what have you seen people try to use for improvised surgical airways?
I'll be honest, I haven't seen a lot of improvised surgical airways. One thing I do talk about when it just comes to airways is like you have to control the tongue. I've seen so many people like panic because the intubation is starting to fail or, their crike is starting to fail. If you can just grab that guy's tongue and you've hopefully given enough narcotics or he's just that far down that he doesn't have any, he's not going to bite you. But if you can just grab that jaw and the tongue and lift, just like you would with a laryngoscope, if you can control the tongue, you control the airway. Mm-hmm. Assuming, again, We're not talking about bullets ripping through and now you've destroyed it. But even then, like I've seen suicide attempts where they try and suck start that shotgun and, you know, they open their whole face up, reach in there, pull the airway open. It's open. Mm. You know, it's not pretty. That's for sure. But air is able to move. But just looking at devices like this, you can get a patent airway. You're not getting a secure airway. So, like, you have to be on the spot when it comes to suction because everything is going down that, you know?
Yep. And an improvised airway, you're just not going to have that balloon to inflate to protect that airway. So I'm a lazy medic. The best way to suction is gravity, right? So if you can flip them over or lean them forward, that let gravity do it, and then somehow secure that improvised airway device so it doesn't slip out because it's slick, right? It's with blood and mucus and everything else. It is definitely not stable. Even when you inflate the tube, that, you know, it can come out so easily. Yeah. So
definitely need to. But looking at these, what do you think about like an NPA?
So use the ABRIC test. Can you breathe through an NPA?
Air will move through an NPA.
Air will move. And funnily enough, that's a great segue into the next one, which is the NPA. So when I started in the late 80s and 90s, the NPA was not hollow. There was no lumen. It was just a solid plastic bit. And it was one length, and we had to measure it and then move the safety pin to make sure that you didn't inhale that tube. So the NPA is there not to breathe through, nor is the OPA there to breathe through. That's, those devices do one thing and one thing only, and it's lift the tongue up the back of the throat, as you can see here with the cadaver pictures, so you can breathe around the tube, not through the tube. And now they have holes in them. Sure, a little air goes through. A little is better than nothing, but that's not what you're trying to breathe through. So to answer your question, I have put an NPA in my mouth, a larger one, and breathe through it. But do you think that would be enough for if that's the only thing you're breathing through? Yeah.
So no, not to. So I would think the real test shouldn't be just, can you breathe through it? Like, can you breathe through it and then go for a run?
I'm going to steal that one, Dennis. That's lovely. You know,
because that's essentially what the patient is going to be going through. And if you can answer,
technique, aren't they?
Yeah. You know, can you breathe through that, you know, once every second? Because that's pretty damn close to what they're probably going to be. Somebody who's desperately needs that airway, that's probably what they're going to be doing. But just looking at that picture, the correct NPA placement, I can't tell you how many times I've seen people, one, tell you, and students doing, where they say, open the mouth, and you open the mouth and you can't see the NPA because it's more comfortable than a correct placement. And just like any airway, you have to control the tongue. You know, either you control the tongue by pushing it out of the way, or you control the tongue by bypassing it altogether, you know, a subglottic airway. But like that picture right there, that's definitely correct placement because it's going to push the tongue up and out of the way.
And if you open the mouth, you should see either the very tail end of the NPA or no tail at all, which means it might be a bit too deep and you can pull it back a little bit. But yeah, if you need to open the mouth and you need to be able to see it. And controlling the tongue is really important. And Wilderness Medical Society have tons of pictures out there where they use a safety pin and they'll poke through the tongue. And I'm not a big fan of that either, because they're saying, if you leave the person, you have to go walk off. As a lazy medic, I'd rather just put them in a safe airway position and let gravity take care of it than start sticking safety pins in the tongues. But
oh yeah,
that's
Imagine waking up and your tongue is wired to your jaw.
That's the other one. Yeah, what are you going to start freaking out? And you're going to yank that, and it's going to cut tons. Now you're bleeding out, and you're already injured. And yeah, so it looks great, but I'm not an avid fan of that one at all. So let's talk about improvised laryngoscopes. And we've had quite a few conversations about this in the college. I can't make it work. I can't. And Wilderness Medical Society is big about putting bent spoons and using torches, flashlights, you know, to try to improvise this. Just do a nasal intubation or do a finger intubation and don't try to get a laryngoscope. The only thing I can think of is if you're in a remote austere environment and you have someone that is choking, like they have, then you need to get access to the airway so you can try to find it and get it out. And if they're, you have to wait until they're unresponsive, because when they're choking, you're not going to be able to shove anything down their gob at all. You're going to just support them and encourage them to cough and sputter. And once they go unresponsive, then you might need to find some way to look down there, get some improvised bayonet shears or bayonet tweezers or something to be able to get that piece of junk out. But other than that, can you think of any other improvised laryngoscope use?
No. And for me, and again, I'm super comfortable doing a crike. And especially now we're bending spoons and things to try and intubate. Like, I think you're too desperate to intubate. Just do a surgical airway. Do it properly. It's going to be way faster than like who has like ready access to a spoon at all times. Do the surgical airway, get him down. And if it happened to be this guy is choking on something, get the airway. Now that's secure. Then go ahead and find your bent spoon or whatever it has, because now you've stabilized the patient. Go ahead and find whatever improvised laryngoscope you need. Open the airway and get your McGill's or whatever it takes to reach in there and grab it. You have a much calmer, much more stabilized patient. Again, I'm just comfortable doing a surgical airway in that situation.
It needs to be comfortable for everyone, because that's the go to hell option, isn't it? Yeah. So improvised suction. This is a suction easy with a drip chamber of an IV tube. You cut the drip chamber in half and it'll fit perfectly on your suction device, and you can use that for your ET tube. And if you need to get rid of secretions, can you think of any other airway things, Dennis?
Just a point on the IV tubing to improvise that whistle tip. Since hopefully you're doing this before you need it. But cut some fenestrations on the distal end of that tube, so that you can place your suction and it goes like into a blood clot or a mucus plug or something like that, you have something that can still suction off to the side. The squids there, they come with a attachment and a whistle tip, and that attachment is the thing that gets constantly stolen, right? Because there's only one thief in the military. Everybody else is just trying to get their stuff back, right? When you get those brand new, take the 4 minutes that it takes to get some, 550 cord or duct tape or something, duct tape the whistle tip to that adapter, and then that entire thing, secure it to the squid so you don't lose it, and hopefully you never have to do an improvised anything.
Mm. Yeah, good point. Good point. And if middle of the night and it's raining and you don't need to faff around too much on where everything is. So yeah, you just grab the suction EZ and everything's attached to it. That's a good way of doing it.
But if you do go down that road because somebody's stolen it, of course, you never lose your stuff. Somebody stole it. But, you know, you prefabricate that thing. And again, you secure it to your squid. Make sure you have some fenestrations on the side, on the distal end. It doesn't have to be a bunch of them, just a couple of them. And then as I see people securing the whistle tip to the squid, well, they'll duct tape it and things like that. And that thing sucks. Well, it's horrible at like sucking out like vomit and larger things, you know? And I have yet to come across an airway that's been dry before. It's always got vomit in it or bone fragments and blood and whatever. So you need that large bore to get those things out.
Yep. Valid point. All right. Moving on to respirations. We'll talk about some of the improvisations you can do. So the SpO2s get lost a lot. And at the college, if you don't tie your finger SpO2 to your wrist, the patient's wrist, I steal it. And I ask my faculty to steal it. I nick them because in real life, I don't know how many of these I've lost. And rolling the patient or dragging them or somebody nicking them. And if they're put a clove hitch around your wrist, you're not going to lose it. So that's one improvisation that we require everyone to do. Do you do that as well at the schoolhouse?
Either something like that, or I think even better is securing it to yourself. Because.
So how are you going to use it on the patient if it's secured to you?
So you have like either a 550 cord or, you know, the retractable, like the scissor retainer, right? Yeah. You pull it out, you take your measurement, you put it back.
Okay. So it's spot checks.
So like the only time, like when do you look at your SpO2, right? Like you're looking at it, measure it and then put it back because they'll secure it. The only downside of securing it to the SpO, to the wrist, one, if it sits on their finger, especially when somebody's volume down, it sits on that spot for too long and just the pressure from the spring compresses the capillaries and it starts to not want to read. Okay. Cause it's been sitting there too long. So you constantly have to kind of move it around to get a measurement. Or you finally get them to evac, right? You do your handover, the handover is perfect.
You forget to grab it.
And you forgot to grab it and your SpO2 and Emma go flying off. And you don't realize it until you now need it.
I like that. I'm totally going to nick that one. That's a really good idea. So I like the retractor wire that you usually have for your shears. That would be really helpful. The only downside of that, Dennis, is I guess once they're hypo-wrapped, you can still do that because you just put their hand out of the hypo wrap to check their SpO2 and then they put their hand back in. Okay. Yeah. Right. I'm with that.
The only time that I would veer from that is if I'm doing some kind of respiratory management where I want constant like updates on what I'm doing, you know, kind of like the Emma, the only time I leave it on the end of the ET tube. So I'm doing respiratory management. I'm taking him from an end tidal of, you know, 60 or whatever it is, you know, down to, you know, whatever my goal is, whether it be 40 or 35, whatever the goal is. But I'm constantly using it. That's the only time I think that you should leave it in place.
Plus, you can use it on multiple patients. Do you have the Emma on the retractor wire as well?
Yeah. Or if I run out of retractor wires, then I use a section of 550 cord because I'm old and I'm used to having 20 feet of 550 cord on me. But but just having it secured to you, the worst thing happens you now have, you know, your SpO2 and your EMA are like dangling around you, and it's at least attached to you.
Yeah. It reminds me of Ranger School. You get so tired there, you just tied everything. Yeah. And you could kind of walk off in your weapon system. Everything would be dragging behind you.
Right.
You wouldn't forget anything. Yeah.
Right.
So
you just look stupid, but at least everything's secure.
Yeah. So yeah, great idea on the SpO2. Oh, hold on a sec. I totally got jumped here. So improvised BVM. So it's sexy. Everyone loves doing this. And our courses in Malta, everyone is just hell-bent on creating this. And I have yet to find anything that didn't have a ton of dead space. So this here is a mattress inflator and a top of a soda, 2-liter soda bottle. And they, to make a seal, they took one of our SWAT tourniquets and they cut that up. And they used that rubber to make a seal for the mouthpiece. So it did work, but I don't know. I'm just not sold. Have you had better experience, Dennis?
No. Thankfully, I've always had just a BVM. I have seen people try and do rescue breathing because they forgot their BVM, but that doesn't fly. Something like this, I see a lot of dead space. Where would be the exhalation port on this?
There isn't one, and that's the issue, isn't it? So
yeah.
they kind of slips out in between the seal, so it's not the best option. I have yet to see anything made that makes sense to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, I could see something like that. Like, it seems like it works well. You know, you have a nice long tube, you can stomp on it with your foot. But you're not controlling the volume without real practice. There doesn't seem to be an exhalation port. So your guy is just going to rebreathe whatever is coming out.
Yep.
And there definitely is not going to do any peep or anything like that either.
Yep. So I'm not a big fan of this one, even though you'll see it. So during our restoration, we got to worry about chest seals. And when I started, we were told the three-sided dressing, which is now gone completely. So just four-sided dressing. Is that what you're teaching at the schoolhouse?
So
you're still doing three-sided.
So, I mean, one, you know, chest seals, you know, either the fully occlusive chest seal or you have the non-occlusive chest seal. Everybody seems like people, they used to essentially, if he's got a cut on his chest between his belly button and his chin, they're slapping chest seals on it. Now things tend to be moving more to our actual assessment of the injury. And if you hear air moving back and forth, then, you know, put a non-occlusive chest seal, whether manufactured or improvised, so that it's less likely to cause a tension. Guys, forget that these things clot as well. And now, regardless you put something on it or not, if it clots, essentially you have a occlusive chest seal and whatever pneumothoraces builds into a tension. But I've definitely seen a big movement from just fully occlusive chest seals on everything to more use of the non-occlusive.
Good. That also means you're not going to burn through their SAMS seals or whatever chest seals you're using. They won't get through them. So do you teach improvised in the schoolhouse?
When they run out. I'm teaching at the refresher course, so it's more experienced guys coming in. Even the students who are going through initially are taught how to do the three-sided.
Okay. So there's both sides of the fence on three-sided and four-sided. So one thought of the four-sided is if you just stop the movement of air, and then if they still have problems, put another needle in, or finger sweep at the critical care paramedic level. We're doing finger sweeps. Are you guys doing that as well as Delta's?
You're talking about just reopening like a finger thoracotomy?
No. Yeah, finger thoracotomy in the on the axilla. Yeah.
Yes. So definitely
that's going to be a better option. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think so it's in a lot of ways, I'm starting to lean towards finger thoracotomies even over needle decompressions, and the reason why I've seen a lot of needle decompressions causing more problems than fixing. Right. And again, you're talking about ideally it's for a tension pneumothorax. Guys kind of race pathophysiology. And it's like, well, he's got a hole in his chest and now he's, you know, having difficulty breathing when he could have a fractured rib. And that's why he's having difficulty breathing. Doesn't mean he has a tension. It just means he's having a hard time breathing. It's your job to figure out why. But they'll kind of jump the gun, they'll drop a needle, and now you've caused it because that lung was up against the chest wall and you've punctured all the way through. And especially when you're hubbing the needle, right? In T-tri-C, hub the needle. I've seen it cause pneumothoraces. I've seen it go into the heart, which ends pretty damn quickly.
Yeah. But
the reason why I'm starting to think about finger thoracotomies being better, I've never been able to puncture the lung with my finger. As harder, as sharp as it may seem, I've never been able to rip open the lung with it.
I suppose you could do a slight laceration with the number 10 scalpel blade, but
I mean,
not your finger.
You know, and I use the Kellys to pump to pop through the pleural wall. You know, and I control the depth with my grip.
You always have your finger there. Yep.
Pop through, and then this is where you can cause damage when you're opening up the Kellys to make your space for your finger. Guys want to grab the handle, and so you have these two forks. Fork prongs there sticking out, and because of the angle as it opens up, the injury slips down, and now you just speared the lung. When I grab the Kellys, I put my thumbs on the you know the prongs here, and so as I'm opening it, I'm controlling the depth with my thumb.
Nice.
And I'm using my fingers here on the handle. So I can get my leverage, but I continue to control the depth with my thumb, and I've just had better success doing that.
I like that. I like that. So yeah, anything you can do to have a stopgap measure of keeping something from going too far in. I agree with the needle D. People use it as an assessment tool. It's not an assessment tool, and at the college we're teaching lateral. So the midclavicular line is completely out. But even so, yeah, I think finger sweeps are definitely the way to go for if the MOI is justified it.
Yeah, and it works. And the finger thoracotomy, it works for air as equally as it does for blood. You know, that the needle D, you might get a couple of drops to come through that, but it's going to clot. And as, you know, the lung expands, it bends over the catheter. I guess now they've got some catheters that have fenestrations on them. So I think they're kind of improving that.
Nice.
But again, I've just seen that needle, especially when they're hubbing it, penetrate into the lung. And now, I mean, you have a small hole, but it's still a hole that now you have to manage.
Yeah, and it's bleeding now
into
that oral space.
Yeah.
Good. So let's talk about stethoscopes. So Liniac created the stethoscope because they didn't want to touch people. So now everyone uses them. Yes, it's better than doing what everyone did before that, which was just put the ear on the chest. But I challenge our paramedic students to do just that and see what they hear with just the ear on the chest versus an improvised stethoscope or an actual stethoscope. So, yes, you can get a loo roll, or you can wind up a magazine and try to hear, but just why? Just put your ear in the chest and don't worry about taking time to improvise a stethoscope. What have you seen guys try to do with improvising a stethoscope?
To be honest, I haven't seen that one yet. But I mean, it makes 100% sense. That's a lot like what they used to do way back in the day. That metal little funnel that they'd stick on people's chests. I think just with anything, once you improvise it, you got to practice with it and appreciate the difference. So you just gotta listen through it.
Yep. And now with ultrasound, fewer and fewer people are using a stethoscope anyway. Nebulizing, you can improvise with just tire pump. This is from the WMS. I've played with this, but I've never used this in anger. Have you ever had to improvise a nebulizer?
No, not the nebulizer. I've had to improvise the spacer there. Yeah. But I've never had to practice do something like that.
What did you use for a spacer?
Not the spacer, but the actual like albuterol puffer.
Ah, okay.
So I had the canister. I didn't have the plastic piece. So I dropped it down. I think it was like a 60 cc syringe. It's like a 30 or 60, it drops down the barrel of that and then use the plunger to activate the little canister.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. No, I haven't come across that one. Cool. So moving on to C, circulation. These are some of the things we'll talk about. So starting with femur traction. So on the right, when I was working in Bosnia, this is a picture I took of the traction splint they used, which are just bottles of soda or water, and hanging it off a side. On the left is what you see in World Medical Society, and I got this photo from TACMED Australia, and just using a stick. WMS loves using paddles or a hiking stick or something like that. We've tried this, and it's wonky at best. And you are bleeding as, 1.5 liters of fluid you can bleed into a pelvic fracture, if I remember right.
A femur fracture? Yeah.
Yeah, a femur fracture, yeah. So, yeah, you need a pull traction if you can. So, but the picture on the left is dual. They have a ratchet strap there, which would probably be scary because... So you need 10% of the body weight pulling traction to have the ends of the femur to kind of line up. And then you remove that potential space so there's no place for the blood to go anyway. And you stop the 1.5 liters of bleeding. But so and then once you have this improvised traction split, what are you going to do with this guy?
Right.
He's even harder to move. So what have you seen as far as improvised femur traction?
So I've seen them use the litter itself. So imagine a litter, and they'll use the handle as the stick. And you essentially, not a Prusik knot, but you get some kind of mechanical advantage and they pull that. I kind of like the idea of a ratchet. Just make sure whatever you're using to secure the ankle doesn't cut off circulation. But I kind of like the ratchet because it's going to be strong enough. Like if you don't happen to have benzos, to make his muscles relax, eventually that contraction is going to go away and you're able to get as much traction as you can, let him finally relax. Hopefully you've done something for pain, but if you happen to not have benzodiazepines to relax those muscles, eventually you're going to be able to overcome that muscle contraction with enough leverage.
And the biggest muscles of the body too. So you're fighting an uphill battle.
Yeah, like I've yet to, without chemical help, I've yet to see somebody strong enough that can physically pull the femur in line. Unless you're talking like a small child, but like a grown adult, I've never seen anybody strong enough that can do that.
So pulling 10% of the weight and then holding that traction whilst you're trying to get something lined up. And we do teach that. We say, all right, get down there, pull, put one foot in the guy's groin, pull and try to get at least some traction whilst you build the thing, or you get the Seger splint open running, or you get the other one. So you need to do something, but you're right. How can you pull 15 kilos of pressure and not move? It's every time you move, you're causing huge amounts of pain and possibly more damage. And yeah, you just can't do that. That's why we need a traction splint. So the challenge I found is making sure that you only pull 10% of the body weight, making sure it's a steady pressure, and then making sure that you don't cut off circulation of the foot. So having a good tie. And the WMS, the Wellness Medical Society, have a brilliant lecture on how you do that ankle hitch knot in such a way that you're not going to be cutting off circulation. But it's and the other problem with the improvised traction is, well, Newton was right, right? For every opposite reaction, you have an opposite reaction. So with your guy on the stretcher, you're pulling and tying his leg to the handle of the stretcher. He's just going to slide down the stretcher as you pull traction. So you have to have counter traction as well. So how would you, so we tie a 3/4 inch nylon webbing or something like that around the groin. And so you can stabilize the top end of that stick as well as the bottom end, which has the ratchet or the Prusik knot or something on it. Otherwise, you're just going to pull the guy around as you try to pull traction. So it's a challenge, isn't it?
That's it for today's podcast. Be sure to go to our website, www.prolongfieldcare.org. Find us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram. Subscribe and stay on the bleeding edge of combat medicine. This is Dennis for the PFC Podcast. Out. Great boy is waiting there for you.